Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Friday, March 22nd, 2024, and we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal. Later on in our program, we'll be bringing you our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll feature dispatches on the recent Israeli Defense Forces bombing of Rafah in the Gaza Strip. The West Asian state of Yemen has provided a military update on its solidarity actions with the people of Palestine. Iraq announced that the United States has reopened talks on their exit from the West Asian state. And there are ongoing military engagements between southern Lebanon and the northern Israeli-occupied territories. In the second and third hours, we will listen to a panel discussion on the situation in West Asia from Electronic Intifada, one of the primary sources on the current situation in Palestine and West Asia. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take our musical interlude in the Democratic Republic of Congo with the music of the legendary Shala Mwana. Let's listen in. And this is the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast Friday, March 22nd, 2024. Let's go back. Music of
immense comme il respire, et ils sont jamais rassasiés. Ils sont dans toutes les sauces. Tous les matins tu t'en vas pour revenir très tard. Tous les soirs tu es fatigué parce que tu as trop travaillé. Tu as eu trop de réunions, mais qui ne t'a fait que des audiences. Et pourtant toi-même tu sais avec qui tu passes ce soir. Tous les matins tu t'en vas pour revenir très tard. Tu es fatigué parce que tu as trop travaillé. Tu as eu trop de réunions et tu ne t'as fait que des audiences. Et pourtant toi-même tu sais avec qui tu passes tes
toujours pour me cacher, on sera se voir, ça va faire.
Grand Papa, no? Travailler, travailler. Tu n'as même plus le temps pour moi. Est-ce que la nuit, les bureaux sont ouverts? Et moi, maintenant, je suis devenue ta sœur ou je suis devenue ta nièce? Tu me tournes de l'autre sens, c'est facile, facile. Ça va, c'est ça,
ma soeur. Les hommes sont des menteurs.
Katonda bakole kutonda nkumba kutonda nibalela kutonda ntonto jiwanyinga lapanga ujika ine malwele munumulwe takwa kwa mama kaya kwa buta kwelele bana baba tala batangula ntang takwangelele takwanyi musumbi jabila takwelele
Kamu
Bando pa mwene di koko mur Mwabwe pa kwen Yo 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 Kemai Muntu abwele mchanukam Kuteke teke mwine Baka shama
Mwanyi mani chia Mami tesu watu abu shemu Mwende otro mjini Mwende mwumu chima mweyo Yo 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 Kemai Yo yo yo
Bakudu kwamba kuseki mwine baka kumina
Kumanyi manyi chia Manu sesu kwa tuwabu shimu Mutu yoto ujini wende mumu chima mweyo Yo 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 kemai Yo 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 manu nyani Uchima senu bambe lwa manu
We mutwe kuchina malwe
Kaka ulonge feyine bikazu ya ulokwe Majina la munda mwele Nane zani wewe kumpala kwa vyoto Uneme kebele jibende Wala kajika tuka mkwezu shabane Muka jabende kule
Mabila ikwa kalo mali Ajibuba toka ni basike Ajimunda mwabu kwa disambe Atonda bando munda mwami chima yabo Baba wanye Baba we, baba wanye, ngabila ikwa kalo mali
Baba wanye, baba, baba wanye, tuabila ikwa kalo mali Baba wanye, baba, baba wanye, tuabila ikwa kalo mali
Mungu jimi kwa yetena, adame ne baba tenga kwa mutu Ila mitu kweza vya nyete Mungu ikwa kalo mali Président africain Jean-Pierre Sa. Yeba oke otikinga na welenga sanko yeba papa otikelinga solo na yo yanto toko yo de disanga na koma kolanda motuka na makolo likola bolingo yo la munanga wapi yo Wido mondo Yeba oke otike nga na wele nga sako yeba papa Otike linga solo na yo yanko toko yo le lisanga Nako mako landa butuka na makolo likolo bolingo yo La mananga wapi yo Kilwa bolingo na moto nanga Obuki moni maitika bankoko Sangamai kasi yote ya mua
Nyoka wa Bulanda,
pata chakulwata kuyi pata kuyi mesa mupanga chakuja bomutanga salado awo pachomba ujaja nenda ukuja wanesa mukwangula mushila muva mwikale wenda wangala kuyichibuta kuyi musheka na shati sabata chakulwata kuyikwata kuyimesa mupanga chakuja bumutana salgado awo kashomba ujaja nenda umuja kulonda wangi meme kukulesha mwakulwata kukupesha nibilamba kukupesha sabanga wa mukuya kakamanya wabajika Atapa watapake Kanyonyo kafika mulun Ya kusomu kwenu mwajisana Naka kunosha mwene jai Mashana jinana jamoyo wai Kwenda nebebu mwanetu Kubalela nibalanda vai Kwenda nebebu babenda Wabaka tende mutoke mutai Mulunda wanda mukama toba Mukaji ni mibi ichite Webe bulanda wapa metu Uchina bala uki minajikoshe Nyoka wabulanda Nyoka wabulela Chisobu kutumba chisobu kuja Chikuja na chine muna mwebe Thank you. bujumuka kabiena kudwila mulopo ubipa mabantu kakamana wata chikondo chilwana tutaka sanka bie wibile iye kakamana mwena kwa iye
Chalangi ni ngasa mutebebe, jiji
mwanda nyimba bantu bongo Tutunu wa sango bantu na nwela kabobo Jale nunganji kutishinga vya nito ye Bajibamba mwipi bamba mujabi Bamba bena vyuma ni bena man Bamba bena lumu bamba bambumo Mumanya malu bajiba kwamba vyebe Mwamu baka zalu pesha kalaji Kanyunyo kabubuka kabu ya kwabu Chalanji mulele kwa mwitika ya mpongo Mulele bilo ni bambi ya mtongo Mwana wabena kaluna wambana Wabato bashi basonga mbala Nji wako bana bene bene Mulaba tukula mulaba mangi ya mushi
Hei bagume umayani Umayani ya bagine Moya ye mume Umayani mitisongela
Nwenda baya ya kusola masola Nasha baya ya kutanya malelo Chana nebutangi ni kuimba kwanye Chana ni mwele njini umayani Kusomba kugulangi nwela koko Zambi alenga michimani mioyo yenu Anupegi muna anupevisu Wapa nwape sanwa mfuluka vyanyi Ibanume
Ibanume umayani Umayani ya madinge
Kananga malandi wa kushinga Mpanda wa chasa bakole
Ngenda ngimba kabula kumkwata Wakatende michinyama
Ngenda ngimba
Ngenda ngimba kabula kumkwata Wakatende michinyama
Kajimujibula
Kajimujibula kanta nyumbuka muji na chala mwana wakufika
Kajimujibula
Kajimujibula kanta nyumbuka muji na chala mwana wakufika
Ngashi kutenga batutu Ile nibiaka kwa kujangu mayai Gitenga buwabwa waka yembe Ulele mwimpe wabachala kajongu Buwabwa mubajati Waka batambanu walungu nini menji Mamba mubia yeji Wewe mulu maji sante Ngenda imba
Ngenda imba kambula kumkwata Wakatende ni chinyama
Ngenda imba
Ngenda Kabula kumkwata mwakatende ni chinyama
Kajimujibula
Kajimujibula kanta nyungu kamuji na chala mwana wakufika
Kajimujibula
Kajimujibula kanta nyungu kamuji na chala mwana wakufika
Kazaji nyembwe ujikapumbu kajenda nkai Tutumu kwa mulumba wabaka jamuji mabashu pachilo Jiji wetu kundegi Pena lukilumbo jiba mupa mupa Ya matangala wafwane ya ye mukashi munene tamba bakwabu Jibe mpiana wachituka Mwa mayi mushale jibia bia Ujimashi ya mumenu binadamu Chuka fashika pitaka bitenda Victoro mukwa ngande keji Wewe muluba wakabamba Victoro mpoyo Mukulumpa wajituma Muchimu nene sangaluba Wakafumi ne mkwangani mupemba
Ngenda ngimba kabula kumkwata Mwakatende ni chinyama
Ngenda ngimba
Ngenda ngimba kabula kumkwata Mwakatende ni chinyama
Kajimujibula
Kajimujibula kata nyungu kamuji na chala mwana wakufika
Kajimujibula
Kajimujibula kata nyungu kamuji na chala mwana wakufika
Kujimai bakwana Kujibili ya mwila wa yombo
Hey,
Fidele wa Mulamba. Bayende wa Mer Kapi, ne Mer Baka. Ukanda wakumbala wabena bolingo, chitupa chaji kuminisi sandubala, jinangadilelela jikale muka chumwezo, jinangadilelela jikwamema mumaju, mumichima ya bantwe.
Kwa kwa
kusha kumbala kwa bango anu kwa kusangisha mashinga mubili tulonga ijeze jibia katonga tidele ujini jina lagu mwena samaria kanangi bufuna bakengi kumbala kwen katonga upapa kabala bala
Abuela muito, o dia que eu te acabei de colocar na, te lembro ainda de mim.
Yesu Kristo ujijile wa moyo. Wakwe kutitatu zambi, mupuki ni mwezi juwa mana. Ujile, nyendanke ba moyo. Moyo, moyo wachendelela. Kanyila kunjifuma, tone kuya yeku. Ujima ujima, moyo wachendelela. Ujila kai, nyendanke ba moyo. Moyo, moyo wachendelela. Kanyila kunjifuma, tone kuya yeku. Ujima ujima, moyo wachendelela. Hey, koko kuna kaya we
jana
ya bayina kabwela we kuna kaya we
jana
jingenda kebanjila kwa petamu koko kuna kaya we
jana
jingenda kebanjila kwa petamu yo.
Take a time. Benda Bavila Vila
Kanumanja Kutwa Sakija Kanumanja Kuja Nongomoro Kanumanja Kutwa Sakija Kanumanja Kuja Nongomoro
Wili Ngompo Abaya Dunia Ninga Kupote
Shala Mwana from the Democratic Republic of Congo. That was a selection of her work. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast on this Friday, March 22nd, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Right now, we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment. These are just some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. Our lead story deals with the current political and security situation in Palestine as Israeli bombings continue in the vicinity of the Al-Shifa Medical Complex. Palestinian resistance remains engaged in confrontations with the occupation forces near the hospital. The Palestinian resistance is engaging in confrontations with the Israeli occupation forces who have moved further into the vicinity of the Al-Shifa Medical Complex in Gaza City. Journalist Alam El-Din Sabah confirmed to Al-Mahdeen. He further noted that the occupation forces intensified their artillery shelling and raids in the vicinity of Al-Shifa Hospital. This escalation is occurring amidst severed communication with medical personnel inside the hospital, which has been under siege by Israeli forces for several days. The journalists pointed out that the families living in the vicinity of the Al-Shifa Medical Complex are calling to be evacuated as a result of the violent Israeli bombing and the ongoing siege. And you can read this article in its entirety over the Pan-African Newswire. In other news from Palestine, an Israeli aggression on Gaza has entered its 168th day The Palestinian resistance factions continue to repel Israeli occupation soldiers and destroy their vehicles on multiple fronts in the Gaza Strip. The Al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas movement, published footage on Thursday evening showing its fighters repelling Israeli military vehicles in the vicinity of the Al-Shifa Medical Complex in Gaza City. In a statement, the Al-Qassam Brigades confirmed that its fighters targeted three Israeli tanks and an armed personnel carrier using the Al-Yassin 105 anti-armor shells, and also engaged Israeli occupation forces with mortar fire in the vicinity of Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. In other news taking place in the West Asia region, Yemeni Ansarullah leader Saeed Abdul Malik al-Houthi underlines that Yemen will carry out more impactful strikes and operations in support of the people of Gaza. The capabilities of the Yemeni armed forces have notably grown, and this was evident in the unprecedented usage of ballistic missiles to strike naval vessels. Ansarullah leader Saeed Abdul Malik al-Houthi said on Thursday in a speech about the latest developments in Yemen and the region. Saeed al-Houthi said the United States, despite its advanced capabilities and weapons, has failed, and it admitted its failure to deter and prevent Yemeni operations in support of Palestine. He received that there have been 407 recorded air raids and naval strikes carried out by the United States and Britain against Yemen, 31 of which took place during this week. Saeed al-Houthi announced that the Yemeni armed forces carried out 479 operations in support of occupied Palestine since Yemeni joined the fight, adding that Yemen forces carried out a new additional operation in the Indian Ocean this week. Saeed al-Houthi saw the lack of movement of British, American, and Israeli ships in the Red Sea and the Arabian Seas and one of the indications of the success of the Yemeni forces. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In Iraq, an interview with the Lebanese al-Akbar, Iraqi's Harzat Hezbollah al-Nujaba, declared that the resistance group supports any action towards the expulsion of U.S. forces from Iraq. Iraq's al-Nujaba resistance movement proclaimed that it would back up any action that aimed to expel the U.S. forces from Iraq. "We have forced the occupiers back to the negotiating table with our strikes," Hussein al-Musawi, spokesperson for al-Nujaba, said in an interview with the Lebanese newspaper al-Akbar on Thursday. The person referred to an agreement between Baghdad and Washington for the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq, noting that the strikes by the resistance on U.S. bases have compelled the United States to return to the negotiating table after years. Quote, "However, so far, clear results have not been achieved from the government's negotiations with the Americans, and what is important for us are the interests of the Iraqi people," unquote, the spokesperson added. Al-Musawi also reiterated the Iraqi resistance movement's commitment to support the Palestinian people and the resistance against the Israeli occupation war machine. And finally, in Lebanon, in solidarity with the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip and their resistance, the Islamic resistance in Lebanon persists in targeting occupation sites and settlements in the northern occupied Palestine. The Islamic resistance in Lebanon, Hezbollah, persists in its efforts to confront the Israeli occupation, standing in solidarity with the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip and the Palestinian resistance. This stance also serves as a response to the occupation aggression towards southern villages in Lebanon and civilian residences. In its most recent operation, the Islamic resistance used artillery shells to target an Israeli force that was entering the Zariat barracks. Furthermore, the resistance targeted two buildings used by occupation soldiers within the Ramat Raftali settlement using missile weapons, achieving direct hits. In a statement, the resistance stated that it targeted a building used by Israeli soldiers in the Zarat settlement with appropriate weapons, confirming a direct hit. With that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we would like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. You'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. Just go to our website, and that is at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you would like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for Friday, March the 22nd, 2024, all you need to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. That was Anita Baker with the track entitled Priceless. And right now we want to move into our Palestine update. This is taken from Electronic Intifada on yesterday. And we have, of course, attempted to stay abreast of developments taking place, particularly in the Gaza Strip, where people all over the world have stood up and demanded an end to the Israeli Defense Forces siege and the support of this siege and coordination of this siege by the United States and Britain, the European Union. Let's listen to this report.
As Israel continues what's being described by human rights organizations as an attempted genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in Gaza, the war of narratives continues.
Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Wednesday, March 20th. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, Asa Winstanley, John Elmer, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 166 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. We have another packed show for you today, including interviews with legendary historian Ilan Pappé and physician Ben Thompson. And later on in the program, a full roundup of videos from the Palestinian armed resistance and a look at the U.S. Army's operation to build a pier in Gaza City with John Elmer. But first, some of the news that we've been covering at the Electronic Intifada. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza is reporting that the official number of Palestinians killed by Israel since October 7th is now approximately 32,000. With 74,000 injured and thousands more missing and buried under the rubble. Israeli soldiers invaded and besieged the Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City at dawn on Monday, the fourth time that the largest medical facility in the Gaza Strip was attacked since November. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza, Israeli forces bombed the specialized surgeries building, setting it ablaze. Approximately 30,000 displaced Palestinians who have been sheltering at the medical complex were trapped. Israeli airstrikes targeted people in residential areas as they tried to escape the incursion, while soldiers ordered them to flee to the south. This video was captured on Monday, showing a young boy holding a car seat in the Shifa Hospital neighborhood saying, quote, "I swear to God, I'm scared. I cannot take this anymore. I swear, I just want to go." That was from Monday. Israeli snipers and armed quadcopters inside the hospital shot those who tried to move, the health ministry reported. At least 150 Palestinians were arrested. During the raid on Al-Shifa, Israeli forces assassinated Faik al-Mahbou, the commander of Gaza's civilian police unit. Al-Mahbou had led recent coordination efforts to deliver humanitarian aid to the northern Gaza Strip, which Israel has been actively thwarting for months as its snipers and tank gunners repeatedly massacre Palestinians awaiting the deliveries. Some Twitter users remarked that the assassination of al-Mahbou was in retaliation for his successful coordination of the shipment of flour. Echoing their previous and unfounded claims to justify the bombing of al-Shifa Hospital, the Israeli army claimed that al-Mahbou was a, quote, senior Hamas operative who was hiding inside al-Shifa Hospital complex, quote, from which he was working to advance terror activity, according to the Times of Israel. Al Jazeera Arabic reporter Ismail Al-Ghul was arrested and kidnapped by Israeli forces during Monday's raid, along with other journalists. He was released 12 hours later. While he was detained, he said he and the other journalists were beaten, stripped naked, blindfolded, and interrogated. For more, read my article, Israel Besieges, Storms Al-Shifa Hospital, on electronicintifada.net. The Israeli army boasted about its invasion and siege on Al-Shifa Hospital on Tuesday, saying they killed at least 50 Palestinians who they labeled as, quote, terrorists, and claiming that they avoided harming civilians, hospital staff, and medical equipment. But of course, that claim was contradicted by photos, videos, and eyewitness accounts. Mutasim Dalul, a journalist in Gaza, reported that a young man released from detention at Al-Shifa Hospital testified that displaced persons, patients, and paramedics were detained by Israeli forces, who divided them into three categories: execution, detention, and deportation to the south of Gaza. Gaza's government media office reported on Tuesday that, quote, hundreds of Israeli occupation soldiers, heavily armed and accompanied by police dogs, tanks, drones, and helicopters, participated in the raid on Al-Shifa Medical Complex. They fired heavily inside the medical compound at patients, displaced persons, and civilians, resulting in the death and injury of more than 250. They also set fire to some facilities inside the hospital. Also on Tuesday, Israeli airstrikes targeted residential blocks inside Nuseirat refugee camp in central Gaza. Amongst the at least 15 killed was another police chief in charge of local distribution of humanitarian aid, Mahmoud Bayoumi. Following the assassination on Monday of Faik al-Mahbou, the commander of the police unit in charge of humanitarian aid coordination efforts, Israeli forces again targeted another member of the Palestinian police force on Tuesday. Quds News Network reported that Ra'ed Albana, the director of police investigations in the northern Gaza province, was killed along with his wife and children in an Israeli airstrike targeting their home. Albana was responsible for securing and facilitating the entry of aid trucks to northern Gaza, the network reported. And last night, Israeli forces assassinated Amjad Hatat, the director of the Emergency Committee in Western Gaza, who was in charge of coordinating the transfer of food aid from the Israeli checkpoint to UN warehouses. The government media office in Gaza says that more than 100 aid workers have been killed and dozens wounded over the past week in eight separate attacks carried out by Israeli forces. In a statement, the media office said that these attacks on aid workers are intended to, quote, perpetuate the policy of starvation and deepen famine on a broader scale. On Tuesday, Israel targeted Palestinians awaiting an aid convoy in Gaza City, killing dozens, including members of the civil aid security teams, in what has now become a daily occurrence. And last night in Jabalia refugee camp, a food distribution center was also targeted and destroyed by Israeli forces. Palestinian children are continuing to bear the brunt of Israel's starvation policy. Mohamed al-Najjar succumbed to dehydration and malnutrition on Tuesday at the European hospital in Khan Yunis, reported Quds News Network. Catherine Russell, the executive director of the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, said last Friday that, quote, the speed at which this catastrophic child malnutrition crisis in Gaza has unfolded is shocking, especially when desperately needed assistance has been at the ready just a few miles away. Al Jazeera reported that on Monday, Israel officially asked the International Court of Justice not to issue emergency orders for it to step up humanitarian aid to Gaza to address a looming famine, dismissing South Africa's request to do so as, quote, morally repugnant. Lawyers for Israel, Al Jazeera added, quote, denied allegations of deliberately causing humanitarian suffering in the besieged enclave, where tens of thousands of Palestinians have been killed and hunger is rising. They said South Africa's repeated requests for additional measures are an abuse of procedures. The international human rights charity Oxfam released a report on Monday slamming the Israeli government and its Western enablers for, quote, failing in its legal responsibilities to the people whose land it occupies and breaking one of the key provisions demanded by the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, to boost humanitarian aid in light of the risk of genocide in Gaza. Oxfam's report titled Inflicting Unprecedented Suffering and Destruction, Seven Ways the Government of Israel is Deliberately Blocking and or Undermining the International Humanitarian Response in the Gaza Strip, identifies how Israel actively prevents the delivery of international aid into Gaza. Quote, punishing all Palestinians living in Gaza by deliberately depriving them of life and safety. Excuse me. The group's Middle East and North Africa director, Sally Abi Khalil, stated, quote, the ICJ order should have shocked Israeli leaders to change course. But since then, conditions in Gaza have actually worsened. The fact that other governments have not challenged Israel hard enough, but instead turned to less effective methods like airdrops and maritime corridors is a huge red flag, signaling that Israel continues to deny the full potential of better ways to deliver more aid. Oxfam stressed that other states are obligated to, quote, take all diplomatic, economic, and political actions necessary to prevent genocide in Gaza, to enable more aid, and to prevent the possibility of Palestinians being forcibly displaced outside of Gaza. States should discontinue their arms sales and other forms of security assistance that would facilitate the risk of genocide and ongoing war crimes and crimes against humanity by Israel upon Gaza, Oxfam said. That report was published at the same time that an update on starvation in Gaza was released by the UN-backed Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, and its Famine Review Committee. The IPC announced that according to its most recent and available data, 1.1 million people in Gaza, half the population, quote, have completely exhausted their food supplies and coping capacities and are struggling with catastrophic hunger and starvation, which is IPC phase 5. This is the highest number of people ever recorded as facing catastrophic hunger by the IPC system, and double the number in IPC phase 5 just 3 months ago. The report adds that approximately 200,000 people in Gaza City and North Gaza governance are imminently at risk of famine between now and May. The World Food Program noted that at least 300 trucks per day would be needed to enter Gaza at the bare minimum, especially in the north, to address the immediate food insecurity. The World Food Program said it has only managed to take 9 convoys to the north since the start of the year. Senior Hamas official Sami Abu Zuhri, speaking to Reuters on Tuesday about the IPC report, said that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was, quote, defying the world and pursuing the killing of the Palestinian people in Gaza by bombs and starvation. U.S. authorities did not immediately respond to a request for comment, Reuters added. But as Aaron Mate pointed out on Twitter, last week, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken boasted that, quote, the Israelis have been not only allowing food in, but also working to make sure it gets in and gets to people who need it. He then took credit for, quote, doing everything possible to maximize aid into Gaza. Today, he admits that 100% of the population in Gaza is at severe levels of acute food insecurity. We'll have more discussions about Israel's deepening policies of starvation as Western countries continue to drop meager amounts of aid by plane, facilitated by Jordan, while thousands of trucks remain blocked at the various ground crossings. And we'll talk about the U.S. Army's role in building a pier on the Gaza coast later on in the program. But for now, that's just some of the news from on the ground in Palestine over the last few days. Please go to electronicintifada.net to read some of our important new features by writers in Gaza, now up on our homepage. And you're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Coming up, we'll have an interview with physician Ben Thompson, and we'll get a full update from John Elmer on the latest military developments in Gaza. But first, Ali, please introduce our first guest.
Thanks so much, Nora. It was so difficult to listen to a lot of that news, but thank you for that very thorough summary. I'm really delighted to introduce Ilan Pape. He's a professor of history at the University of Exeter in the UK and director of the European Center for Palestine Studies. Many of you will know that Ilan gained renown as one of the New Historians, a group of Israeli scholars who in the 1980s shattered long-standing Zionist lies about the founding of Israel and corroborated what Palestinians had been saying all along about the ethnic cleansing and massacres that they survived during the Nakba in 1948. He's the author of many, many books, far too many to mention here, but two of them are A History of Modern Palestine, One Land, Two Peoples, and The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. Ilan is also a regular contributor to the Electronic Intifada. He is, of course, a distinguished scholar, but he has also been a prominent and longtime advocate and voice for the liberation of Palestine from Zionism. And I hope I can also say that I consider Ilan to be a very dear friend as well. Welcome, Ilan.
Hello, Ali, and everyone. It's a great pleasure and honor to be on the live stream with Electronic Intifada, and thank you for your kind introduction.
Thank you, Ilan. First, let me just ask you how you're doing. We're all now, it's more than 5 months of this genocide, almost six, and I just want to ask you how you're doing.
It's very difficult. I find it difficult to concentrate on my regular work. I find it difficult to sleep. I'm fully aware of what goes on. It's heartbreaking. It's infuriating. And all one can do is double or triple our efforts, first of all, to stop the genocide, but continue also the long strategic aim of liberating Palestine. So personally, of course, all of us are preoccupied with this. We are not suffering as the people of Gaza do, but I'm definitely feel the pain, and this is for me, and I'm 70 years old this year, is the worst period I experienced personally in the history of modern Palestine.
I know that we all feel very similar. Ilan, we're going to discuss a lot of the issues you raised, but first I want to remind you, I'm sure you haven't forgotten, that in 2006 you wrote for the Electronic Intifada, and I quote, "A genocide is taking place in Gaza." You described this later as an incremental genocide, but 18 years ago you wrote these words, "Nothing apart from pressure in the form of sanctions, boycott, and divestment will stop the murdering of innocent civilians in the Gaza Strip. There is nothing we here in Israel can do against it. Brave pilots refuse to take part in the operations. Two journalists out of 150 do not cease to write about it, but this is it. In the name of the Holocaust memory, let us hope the world will not allow the genocide in Gaza to continue." You wrote that in 2006. Clearly, there is nothing incremental about the genocide today. Given your clarity about where Israel was headed back then, are you surprised by the savagery and brutality that Israel is perpetrating today?
I must say that although I did expect a very brutal and ruthless Israeli reaction to the operation of the Hamas on October the 7th, I did not foresee them such a magnitude of inhumanity and such a level of criminality and dehumanization as Israel has inflicted on the people of Gaza. I mean, I did anticipate a very ruthless and violent reaction, but I must say that this is beyond anything I could imagine. And I think you're absolutely right. Whereas I think the years of siege were incremental genocide in the sense of creating conditions which were uninhabitable for people in Gaza. This is a genocide that is taking place in front of our eyes on a daily basis. There's nothing incremental about it, and it's really a vicious, intentional attempt to use the 7th of October as a pretext to deal with what Israel has been unable to deal with, which is the presence of nearly 2 million Palestinians in this part of historical Palestine. And they seem to think that they have now an historical opportunity, and there is no moral inhibition in implementing the idea of removing Gaza or, wiping out or erasing Gaza, the strip, not as a city, the strip as a whole, from the map of Palestine.
Ilan, you have a unique perspective as an Israeli who's completely rejected Zionism, and yet Israel is the society you grew up in. Tell us about what you see happening inside Israel 48 today. What are the political and social realities that have brought us to this point where seemingly an entire society is united around the goal of the extermination of a people they've already, for 80 years, a century, subjected to dispossession, occupation, apartheid, and persecution?
You know, in 1999, I wrote an article for the Journal of Palestine Studies examining the Israeli educational system, cultural system, and political system. And I argued in that article in 1999 that the next generations of Israelis who will go through the official Israeli educational system, through the socialization in the army, through the media indoctrination, would become even worse than the early Zionist settlers, become a group of supremacist, racist, a group of people that would inflict disasters not only on historical Palestine, but also in the area around Palestine. I'm afraid I was totally correct in this assessment, and this was based on analyzing the content of the textbook, the curricula, and the basic messages that young Israeli Jews were getting through the various socialization systems in Israel. So what we see now, namely the fact that more than 97% of the Israelis support the genocide in Gaza, is not surprising, unfortunately. It's a society that is used to dehumanize the Palestinians ever since it set foot in Palestine in the late 19th century, in particular when its leaders committed the ethnic cleansing of 1948. You cannot massively kill people. You cannot be totally indifferent to the death of babies, for babies operated without anesthetics, to children burying children, and for your own army committing one war crime after the other, unless you totally dehumanize the victims of these kinds of policies. And dehumanization doesn't come easily to people, contrary to what people think. You need to work on it. You need to socialize people. You need to indoctrinate them to such a level. But this is a fact now. And the fact is that, of course, there are Israeli individuals who are not like that, thank God. There are not all of them like that, but the vast majority are. And this includes the soldiers in the Gaza Strip, the generals, the pundits who comment in the Israeli media about the actions, not to mention, of course, the political leaders. And therefore, we come back to the point we already made before, that don't expect for a change within Israel to occur in order, if you are wishing, like all of us should wish, for these terrible crimes against the Palestinians to cease. If you really want to stop genocide, and let's not forget the killing of 400 people in the West Bank, if you really want to stop these policies now and those that Israel is planning in the future, the only way is the pressure from the outside. There are moments in history where you cannot rely on a rogue state to change from within, and it has to be pressured to change. And there are the means of doing it, as we have seen in the case of apartheid South Africa and similar cases in history.
We're definitely going to talk about that, but we want to take advantage of your deep knowledge and scholarship and go back to some more historical context Some 80% of the population in Gaza are refugees from cities, towns, and villages that are now part of Israel, the 1948 areas, including the lands where some of the kibbutzes that were raided on the 7th of October have been built. Talk to us about the history of the so-called Gaza envelope, of the people in Gaza, and what Israel's policy towards them has been.
Yes, I think it's a very important point, Ali, because people may think that there always was a Gaza Strip. Before 1948, there was no Gaza Strip. There was a town called Gaza and small and large villages around it. On the road, the Via Maris, the main road on the Mediterranean between Alexandria in Egypt and Alexandretta in Turkey. It was a very pastoral place and very cosmopolitical because so many people were using the road and going through Gaza. It had all three religions were represented in the town of Gaza, the Muslims, the Christians, and the Jews, and it was quite a beautiful spot in historical Palestine. When Israel began its ethnic cleansing, it was trying to massively move people outside the borders of what became the state of Israel. So people were moved, Palestinians were moved to the north, to Lebanon and Syria, and to the east, to Jordan. However, the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were removed and pushed by force from the center and south of Palestine were directed towards Egypt, but Egypt was unwilling to accept the Palestinian refugees. So the Israeli leaders decided to concede, in inverted commas, 2% of Palestine, although they had the power to occupy it, and create this rectangle that became the Strip as a receptor for all these hundreds of thousands of Palestinians that they have expelled from the central and south of Palestine. Now, the last wave of expulsion was exactly from those villages on whose ruins some of the settlements that were attacked on the 7th of October were built. We have in the Israeli archive a document from the 25th of November, 1948, called Order Number 40, which is sent from the central command to the commanders in the area that today would be called the area around Gaza. And it lists 11 villages, and the order is to burn them and expel the people from them to Gaza. On the ruins of these villages, the settlements were built. So what you have in Gaza is a second and a third generation of people who were not just removed forcefully from the rest of Palestine, but also people who are direct descendants of the people who were expelled from the villages on which the kibbutzim and development towns were built around the present Gaza Strip.
And also, Ilan, talk about, and by the way, a couple of weeks ago, we spoke about a story I'd written with David Sheen, which focused on, I think it was Kibbutz Nir Oz, which is one of several kibbutzes built on the land of Al-Ma'in, a Palestinian community, which was largely the home of members of the Abu Sitte family, including Salman Abu Sitte, who has written himself about what he witnessed in 1948 as a child. And the land of Al-Ma'in and the Abu Sitte family is now where several of these kibbutzes sit. Talk to us also about the city of Al-Majdal, Asqalan, which is now Ashkelon, because I think many people know that most of the Palestinians were expelled in 1948, starting in 1947, in 1948. But the expulsions did not stop after 1948, after the establishment of the State of Israel. Is that correct?
Absolutely correct. And it was not out of a strategic decision because of technical issues that had to do with some problem of coordination in the Israeli army. The thousands of people who lived in Majdal Ashkelon were not expelled in 1948, and they were instead enclaved in an area which the Israeli military governors themselves called the ghetto. And in the ghetto, in Majel Askalan, in the ghetto, most of the population of Majel Askalan lived between 1948 until 1950. And while they were living in those enclaves, the Israeli Jewish city of Ashkelon was built around them. In 1950, the Israeli army decided to, it was a political decision by the government led by David Ben-Gurion, that this is not a very healthy situation for the new immigrants who were sent to Ashkelon, many of them coming from Arab countries, and there was always a worry that, the Arab Jews and the Palestinians might find a common conversation, a common basis for a dialogue and so on. So it was decided to forcefully add them to the people who were already refugees in the Gaza Strip. And because this is 1950, and there's already new reporters, Israeli reporters and other reporters, we have quite an extensive documentation on the very process of the expulsion, namely the fact that people were shot above their heads to make sure that they leave. Ironically, Israel was expelling thousands of people who were regarded as citizens of Israel, according to the Independence Declaration of the State of Israel, boasting equality for everyone. And the only reason that they were expelled was that they were Palestinians. And that is important. And as you rightly say, this did not only happen in Ashkelon, in Majdal Askalan. Between 1948 and 1967, and especially in the first 10 years of Israel's statehood, dozens of Palestinian villages were emptied by force by the Israeli army on the borders with Lebanon, Jordan, and expelled to the other side of the border.
You mentioned, Ilan, that many of the people that Israel moved into the former lands and homes of the Palestinians around what is now the Gaza Strip were Arab Jews. Talk about that. Why did they send Arab Jews to those areas? And what role did Arab Jews play in the establishment of Israel?
The Zionist movement original impulse was to create a European Jewish state on the ruins of Palestine. And until 1948, the Zionist leadership showed very little interest in the Jewish communities in the Arab world for two reasons. One, these communities did not suffer from anti-Semitism, and therefore there was no impulse in those communities compared to the communities in Central and Eastern Europe in particular, to leave a place where they lived for hundreds, and in the case of Iraq, thousands of years. So that's one reason that it was not easy to induce them anyway to come. And secondly, until 1948, they were regarded as Arabs, and therefore there was no wish by the European Zionist leadership to Arabize the Zionist project, so to speak. However, after the Holocaust and the loss of 6 million Jews in Europe, and the fact that a lot of Jewish survivors from the Holocaust did not choose Israel as a destination, and preferred to go to England, the United States, or even go back to some of the European countries from which they originally came, there was a demographic need, or Israel wanted a demographic injunction to increase the number of Jews in Israel. And there, after 1948, Israel began a massive campaign to try and persuade the Jews from Arab countries to come to Israel. They use all kinds of methods, different ones. We don't have time, and maybe one day we can have a deeper conversation about it. But I will just give two examples to show how different communities had to be approached differently by Israel. In Yemen, where the community was far more religious, they spread the ideas and lied to the Jews of Yemen that Israel is a very theocratic religious place where you know, Jews can practice Judaism, which of course was not the case in 1948. And in Iraq, they planted bombs in Iraqi synagogues in order to persuade the Jews to come to Israel. However, after they all came, about 1 million of them, they were still regarded by the Zionist leadership as Arabs. So they had to be de-Arabized. And there were several methods that were used to de-Arabize them. One was to locate them on the geographical margins of the state near the boundaries with the Arab states, where it was very clear that these were very active borders in terms of frictions and clashes. And that would, the hope was that it would increase their animosity towards the Arabs in general. Another way of doing it was to force them to change their names, to be totally alien to their roots and language, and so on. Unfortunately, even without that indoctrination, many, and especially this is particularly true about the North African Jews, they felt that the best way to be initiated or to be accepted as equals in the Israeli European Jewish society was to show animosity and hatred towards the Arabs in general and towards the Palestinians in particular. And that is why the right-wing parties in Israel, the more fascist parties and the more extreme ones, can rely on especially North African Jews to provide with them the electoral force in national elections. So they were used, they are victims, as Ella Shochat rightly says, they're also victims of Zionism. However, as can happen in societies, they, instead of directing their anger and their outrage towards the people who really victimized them, they thought that it's easier to direct it towards the Palestinians who had nothing to do with their suffering, with their uprootedness and a lack of equality within the Israeli Jewish society.
Ilan, I want to talk a little bit more about the kind of strategic location of these kibbutzim in the so-called Gaza envelope area and how the Israeli state has used these colonial settlements as kind of, you know, ramparts for, you know, military surveillance of the Gaza Strip. Can you talk a little bit about the strategy of Israeli policy of placing these, you know, these seemingly innocuous, you know, farmland, you know, sort of they were branded as like a socialist utopia, these kibbutzes. But what intention was there in building them so close to what's now the Gaza Strip?
Well, this is typical of settler colonial movements. The settler colonial project is a structure. It never stops. And it has to occupy a land that belongs to indigenous people and occupy it again and again, because there's always a risk that the indigenous people would not sit peacefully when they are dispossessed from their land. So what happens is that you totally militarize the civil space. So any settlement, especially on the borderline between areas that have already been colonized and areas that haven't been yet colonized, those who sit on the border, on the one hand, they are civilians and they lead civic life, but on the other hand, they are also soldiers, they are also military, and therefore they carry guns and they are functioning as the outposts in a military sense towards the so-called enemy. So I think that they play a very important role in the colonization. First of all, historically, they played a very important role in the colonization. And of course, they play a contemporary role in policing the millions of Palestinians. In between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean, there are millions of Palestinians, and Israel polices them in different ways. It uses the Jewish settlements in the West Bank in a similar way to be part of the policing of the oppressive metrics of power alongside military bases, alongside the secret service operation, and unfortunately also with collaboration with the Palestinian Authority in some places. And inside Israel, they're using the Jewish settlements in the Galilee and in the Nakab in a very similar way. So, they tried to do it in Gaza as well until 2005, but because Gaza doesn't mean much biblically, they couldn't get a large number of Jews to settle in Gaza itself. And that's when Sharon said it's much better to take them out and create this huge prison called Gaza and attack it from the outside without worrying of the fate of the settlers in the inside. If you think about it, that Hamas in many ways enabled us to go back to that situation where this pharmaceutical Israeli idea that Gaza can be totally disassociated from the from Israel and only be attacked without any danger to Israel. The Hamas always challenged that, first with the Hamas with the rockets and now with this particular operation. So I think yes, it's a kind of a reality where you know, probably best described as Israel being an army with a state rather than a state with an army.
Ilan, we could talk about you know, the history and the context is so important to understanding the present day, because you know, Israel and its supporters want us to believe history started on October 7th. And that's always, you know, history starts from whatever moment is most suitable to those powerful and to the oppressors. But you were so prescient all those years ago when you wrote about genocide in Gaza. And it wasn't a word that anyone used lightly about Israel's actions. It was almost unimaginable at that time to think that the International Court of Justice could be considering a case very seriously as to whether Israel is perpetrating genocide, and they've already found that it is a plausible case and ordered Israel to stop all genocidal acts, which of course Israel hasn't done. I want to ask you, thinking about the situation in Israel, where do you see things heading? What will it take to stop this genocide? What can pierce this fanaticism of this Israeli population? You alluded to that earlier, but I want you to explore that more.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I'm afraid that we have to, as painful as it is, distinguish between the very near future and the more distant future. I'm afraid that in the near future, although it seems that Israel is acting in such a way that we begin to see actions like the Canadian government's decision to stop suspend arms supplies to Israel and so on, that, you know, in terms of the BDS movement, we are beginning to see the sanctions and not just the boycott and divestment. But as we can notice, first of all, it's incremental, it's piecemeal, we don't even know whether it's really happening. Not that I'm underestimating the symbolic force of that. So I think it might have an accumulative impact on Israel, but knowing the Israeli society, it would have to be far more severe, far more direct, far more transparent that this is really happening. And it has to do with the treatment of Israeli sports teams in the world, music, arms sales, and so on. And, you know, whereas maybe the global south would move a bit quicker, I think, towards that kind of action, I'm afraid that the global north would take far more time, not to mention the United States, and God knows what the American elections would mean for that kind of action. So I'm afraid, if I'm very honest, if I'm bitterly honest, I cannot see an effective international action within a year or year and a half. I can see it later on. I can see it later on. But by the way, I don't want to sound as if I would raise my hands and say there's nothing we can do because of that. No, I'm just saying that if we cannot be observers and think that this is a dynamics that happened by themselves. It means every one of us who is involved in this should double and triple their efforts and not kind of take for granted that, you know, the ICJ and later the ICC or other organization are strong enough at this moment in time to force Israel. There's also another problem with Israel. It can seem to accept certain things, and then it does them incrementally. It does them, you know, in a different way, but from the Palestinians' victims' point of view, it's the same kind of thing. So I wish I had, a successful formula for the next year or so. I see that the resistance continues. I think that we should pay attention to a possible more severe resistance in the West Bank. We don't yet know what will happen in the north of Israel or Palestine, but I think we have to take into account that you do not stop such a criminal act in one day. It's terrible to say it because I know what it means on a daily basis, but I want to be brutally realistic here and not, you know, not promise something that isn't. But if I may, I do really believe, and this I say as a scholar, not just as an activist, I really, and I said it before and I'm going to say it again in every stage, as a scholar, I can see clear indications that the Zionist project is entering its last phase. It's the beginning of the end of this project. It's not sustainable. It's not sustainable from from looking at it from the inside, the Jewish society. It's imploding from the inside. There is no cement that holds the various groups in Israel together. It's not sustainable because I think young Jews all over the world would stop equating Zionism with Judaism. It's not sustainable because the Palestinian younger generation have a much better vision and ideas of how to push forward the liberation struggle. And it's not sustainable because of Israel's economic problems and the possibilities of changes in the region and definitely in the way the international community treats Israel as a pariah state. However, these processes will take more time, but they will happen. So there is a kind of a dawn after this dark night, but I would be irresponsible if I would say that I know exactly how to end this night, terrible period today. But I do want to beseech anyone who's listening to us, it's working in a sense that you cannot see the full picture, but it works if it's relentless, if it doesn't stop, everything we are doing is done 24/7 as much as we can, because I do think the more accumulative the impact is, the shorter the period in which Israel finally would be held to be accountable and maybe begin to pay the price that apartheid South Africa paid during the beginning of the sanctions when they started. The civil society actions of boycott and divestment are very important. But I think that we need to find a way of moving, as I said, between the B and D to the S. I think that's a very crucial idea. And if I may add to this, of course, we're still looking desperately at the Arab world and the Muslim world to do much, much more. And they can. They really can do much more than they have done so far. Without going into the domestic issues of their politics, even with the current regimes that are there, I don't think they have exhausted their possibilities of lending an effective hand to the overall efforts in the world to stop the genocide as soon as possible.
So, Ilan, you said that Israel is imploding in a way. The Zionist project is imploding. what does that mean? Do you think we can look forward 10, 20 years and say that Israel would still be there, or Israel might be gone? I mean, at what, you know, I know that nobody can put a date on it, but where does this process of implosion lead in your view?
Yeah, I think what we can see quite clearly is a takeover of Israel by the more theocratic, more extreme group of Israelis, whom I called in one of my last pieces, the state of Judea, the state of the settlers. It takes over the state of Israel. I mean, both the state of Israel, which is the more liberal Zionist side, and the theocratic, messianic Jewish side, the state of Judea, both of them, of course, believe in the apartheid system and occupation and colonization of Palestine, but they have different view of what the Israeli Jewish society should look from the inside. And I think all those Israelis who still think that they can uphold apartheid alongside a multicultural society, an open society, a liberal society, are losing very quickly their political power. They already are absent from the higher echelons of the Secret Service, of the Mossad, of the army, of the political, important political junctures where policies are taking place. Now, this kind of Israel, the Judea Israel, if you want, would be find it even more and more difficult. They don't even believe it's important to have international legitimacy, but they would find it more and more difficult to get this legitimacy, which means a lot of other people would leave, would not want to stay, regardless of the situation with the Palestinians. It's just not the kind of place they want. And if they have the money, if they have the passports, if they have the profession that can relocate them and their capitals outside, they will do it. So I can see a drain of a certain group of Israelis who are the elite and who pay 80% of the Israeli taxes outside of Israel. And so I think it's a process of collapse that I cannot exactly predict how it would look at the end of the collapse, but I can definitely point to the cracks in the building, if you want, and they're getting wider and wider. The one thing I would just like to add is that when such a structure collapses or even weakens to such a level, it creates a void. And if the Palestinian National Movement is not there to fill the void, this is a chaos that can continue. So it's not always an assured formula for building something new, unless there is, you know, a preparedness for that kind of historical reality unfolding. But I do believe that this is not, it's not sustainable. It's not working anymore.
Do you see in terms of, I assume you closely observe the Israeli press and media, and of course you have still connections to a country you were born in. Do you see Israelis talking about this among themselves? Is this, you know, it's a common thing for people to say, oh, you know, a lot of Israelis have second passports, which is true. A lot don't, particularly the Arab Jews or the Jews from Arab countries are the least likely to have second passports, probably. But Jews who have connections to North America, Canada, Europe, and so on do. So do they talk about this? Is it already happening? Is this departure already happening? What can you tell us from your close observations of discussions within Israeli society?
Yeah. First of all, I should say that up to the 7th of October, there was already clear indications of people relocating themselves and their capital outside of Israel. Not in huge number, but in significant numbers in terms of the quality of the capital that they had and the position that they had in the Israeli economic elite. So this is a process that began before the 7th of October. In a way, the 7th of October stopped for a while in the name of, you know, a kind of instinctive unity in reaction to the 7th of October, but it is resuming. So it is happening. I think that there are two kinds of conversations in Israel that are taking place. There's one, but both conversations have something in common. And the common thing is that it's clear that the next 50 years, the only promise in the horizon that Israeli politicians and leaders have for Israelis is continued bloodshed and wars. This is very clear. And you hear it also from Israelis who support the war and probably don't have the passports to go out. They understand that Israel in the next 50 years is a state that at best defeats, if you want, its enemies, but is all the time constantly a militarized zone, even if, you know, in a successful scenario, that you manage that. That's one conversation. What can we do? This is our life. Some of them would buy into Netanyahu's idea that this is a lot of Jews because of anti-Semitism and there's nothing you can do. I think there is another conversation which says, is it really the only way to live? Again, I would have loved to say that this has anything to do with compassion towards the Palestinians, realization of the criminality towards the Palestinians. It is not yet. Who knows? Maybe this will come as well. But for the time being, it's just a realistic view at a situation where, especially after the 7th of October, you say to yourself, so this is my life now. So if I love military life, and some people do, and I love wars, and I love, you know, if I like that kind of existence, yes, maybe I'm in the right place, you know, like Sparta in ancient times. But if at all there is a modicum of desire in me to have what one should call maybe normal life, this is not the place to be in. Again, I even detach it from the Palestinians. It's almost like saying, I've built this state to be a safe haven for Jews all over the world. And it is the most dangerous place for Jews to be in right now. And that's a contradiction you don't easily gloss over.
Yeah.
And the numbers are very clear. So this is not something you fabricate. You can easily, they know it. It's not very safe to be an Israeli Jew. It's the only place where it's not really safe. They are exaggerating anti-Semitism elsewhere. Jews are not killed, are not being attacked, apart from very small individual numbers, because they are part of an alien, oppressive colonialist presence in the midst of the Arab world. They have created insecurity for them, which unfortunately also radiates and projects on some Jewish communities in the world as well.
And yet Biden himself has said that there is no safe place but Israel for Jews all over the world. I mean,
Biden has said so many things. He said he's a Zionist president. Right. We can tell him that the World Zionist Congress is looking for a new president.
Right in.
Yeah. I mean, what American politicians have said since the 7th of October, especially Secretary of State and the president, really, I mean, this is beyond anything we're used to. You know, I just finished a book which will come out in the end of the month called Lobbying for Zionism on Two Sides of the Atlantic, examining the history of lobbying for Zionism both in Britain and the United States. And there were such moments of pathetic expressions by American leaders, but I think nothing comes close to what we've heard from American leadership since the 7th of October, especially in the first 2 months.
I wanted to quickly ask you about, I mean, you know, you were talking about Israelis leaving and you know, escaping this fantasy that was never realized, obviously, as a settler colony. But what do you think are the prospects of the settlers, who have been evacuated from the kibbutzes around Gaza and also in the north of historic Palestine? Do you think they'll ever go back? Where do you think the maps will be redrawn once this is over?
Yeah, very difficult to say. I mean, some of the people in the envelope area are coming from development towns, so they don't have that many options to live elsewhere. So I think they will return. The members of the kibbutzim, I think some of them will not. The North is a big question. As far as they are concerned, unless Israel occupies south of Lebanon, they're not going back. So the Israeli government has really a huge challenge there. It just adds to the other challenges. But you have to remember that the main problem is not so much how the map would look like. I think there's a much more fundamental problem for Israel. The government is not functioning. There's no government. It doesn't function. The only services people, the only effective service Israeli Jews receive are from the civil society. I mean, it is a civil society that is, you know, experienced in situations of war and emergencies, and therefore it reacts and was able to provide, food, housing, and so on, which the government should have done. But the government is not functioning. It has a lot to do with the personality of the prime minister, but not only. So I think that no less important is not only the question whether they will return or not, whether Israel would return to what it used to be, at least an effective state, at least as far as its Jewish citizens were concerned. We are now nearly half a year since the 7th of October, and there's no indication for it. And we know how Israeli electoral system works with the coalition government and so on. So even if there is a group of politicians, let's say, that are a bit more competent and would enable to reignite or reactivate the state systems and ministries, they would rely in a coalition of people who are either messianic or are totally incompetent. And therefore, it all adds to this picture, which I think that quite a few Israeli Jews would agree with me, not many, but more than ever before, that this is not working. This is not working. I mean, I would like to explain to them that it's not working because originally you cannot impose yourself on a different country and take it over and be an alien in an area. But they haven't reached that level of analysis. But they're just looking at the reality and it's not working, and they can't see where the alternative for it will come. The total reliance on the United States is suddenly hit them in the face. I mean, the biggest worry in Israel is now is from every time Netanyahu opens his mouth criticizing Biden, many Israelis fear that he doesn't realize that without the United States, militarily and economically, Israel is not sustainable. I don't think we ever were in that situation. If history teaches us anything, these kinds of processes begin very slow, but then they accumulate speed and then they become very dramatic and monumental, as happened in the Soviet Union, in South Africa and other places, or South Vietnam around the world.
It's really a very far cry, Ilan, from the image of Israel that I remember growing up with in the 1980s, which is, even if we saw Israel as a usurper state, an aggressor, as an occupier, there was a certain sense that Israel was strong, competent, that even if it had a lot of support from the United States, that it was very capable, and that Israel could do anything. And it's remarkable how totally that has unraveled, and Israel looks as dysfunctional as any state in the region that you could point to, or any state in the world for that matter. And the image of the brave, courageous, capable Israeli soldier has completely collapsed into these, not to say the brutality wasn't there, of course it was, as your own work has documented the massacres and the brutality from the very beginning, but nonetheless there was this idea of the capable and brave Israeli soldier, you know, the raid at Entebbe, the heroism and so on, the Mossad, the long arm of the Mossad, which could reach anyone anywhere in the world at any time. Now they look like thuggish, brutal clowns, and they don't scare anyone. They horrify and disgust, but they don't inspire awe and fear in the way that that they did. Do Israelis have a sense of this change? Do they understand, do they see this change in their image and understand it?
It's interesting. I think it's kind of a mixed picture. On the one hand, they say to themselves, and I read it in many and talked with people there, saying, imagine what would have happened if Hezbollah would have coordinated with Hamas a joint attack on Israel on the 7th of October. How would Israel would have fared? And we're still talking about two guerrilla armies, not two conventional armies, you know, armies without aeroplanes, tanks, and proper artillery. So on the one hand, there is this idea that Israel is not invincible, that it doesn't function. On the other hand, they're trying to create a new story of heroism under the fog that we all don't know exactly what happened on the 7th of October. So they begin to build these stories of heroism on the day itself, and of course, heroism in Gaza and so on. So they're trying to rebuild this image of heroic, competent army. I don't think it sticks. I don't think it holds water. So I think they are aware of it. Again, it's the kind of thing that you have to remember that it's this reality is being faced by people who generation after generation were indoctrinated in a certain way. It becomes kind of part of their DNA, if you want, or mentality, or as they call it in Arabic, akliya, that anything like this is due to anti-Semitism, due to the fact that everybody hates us, nothing to do with what we're doing and so on. It may still work with some Israeli Jews, this idea that, you know, this is a terrible period. We have nothing to do with it. It's done to us because that's the lot of Jews throughout history. I think that some of them begin to doubt whether this is effective. I remember people were totally surprised when I talked to audiences. I remember in Australia and other places. They really don't believe it, but recently the BBC even admitted this. Is most of the Israelis consume news only from the Israeli media. They really have not seen one, you have to remember that, they have not seen one picture from Gaza that tells you about the suffering of the people of Gaza. Not one picture in the last 6 months. And they, I know that they can have access to other alternative media, or even, you know, even the mainstream media in the West is enough to give you some indication, but they don't know, and they don't want to know, and even if they know, the dehumanization in such a level that it doesn't. So it's a complex situation where one of the things we should, and I think it's up to us, the anti-Zionist Jews who were born in Israel, to work on this. And this should not trouble the Palestinians. It's not the Palestinian problem. But I think it's up to us to tell them that there is an alternative. There is an alternative. It's very difficult because they are so brutal now, but there are still millions of people, and not all of them were born, you know, criminals and heartless and so on. There is an alternative, and you know, you've written about the one-state solution. I've written about the one-state solution. We did not imagine a Judenreich state. We didn't say that these states would have no Jews in them. We just talked about a state of a liberated, decolonized, and based on equality. Because, you know, I'm part of the one-state democratic initiative in Israel, and the initial reaction was, let's not talk about it now. You know, it's not the time. I'm not sure about it anymore. At first, I agreed because, you know, we all wanted to focus on how to stop the genocide. I still think that talking about a horizon, which is different from the one we're seeing here, is something that is worth talking about. But as we said at the beginning of the conversation, the process of deprogramming Israeli Jews, or waiting for them to wake up or understand, maybe with the distance of time and so on, is not a precondition for the liberation of Palestine. It's not a precondition. Yeah,
Ilan, that's something I would love to hear about in the future as you make those points. We'd love for you to come back and talk about the reactions. It's so fascinating for us. One thing I'll say, when you talked about how Israelis only see Israeli media, another phenomenon I've noticed is it seems they think nobody else sees Israeli media, that that what they say in Hebrew is like a private conversation only among Israelis. And that's why it's such a rich source for us. A lot of the reporting we do is simply translating what comes from Israeli media, because they're so much more honest with each other. You know, they think no one else, that Hebrew is a secret language no one else can decipher.
Yeah.
So it's a terribly useful source for us. Just we just have a couple of minutes. I have one question for you, and I think Nora has one. Since I'm speaking, I'll go first. Ilan, you were born in Haifa in Palestine to German Jewish parents, if I'm correct. What would you say now, what do you say now to the German people and the leaders of Germany?
Yeah. This is a very important topic for me. In one sentence, almost like a soundbite, but I will explain it in two more sentences after that, I would say that Germany was once on the wrong side of history, and I don't know why it insists to be once more on the wrong side of history. And what I mean by this, of course you understand what I mean by this, but I would just to make sure that everybody understands what I'm talking about it, I think that the fact that the Germans think that they absolve themselves from what has been done by the Nazi Germans in the Second World War by supporting unconditionally and without any inhibitions the colonization of Palestine and the present genocide, they are abusing the Holocaust memory. They are not compensating for what they have done, but rather they are leaving it as an open wound rather than allow it to be healed. And the second point I would say that I'm really surprised. I speak German, so as you say that Hebrew is not a secret language, German is not a secret language to me. And I cannot understand how intelligent people, educated people, coming from a society that has a lot to contribute and has contributed to civilization, how these intellectuals and educated people appear to be so stupid and superficial in the way that they express themselves when it comes to the question of Israel and Palestine in general, and especially to the situation that unfolds in front of our eyes now. It's quite painful to see people parroting the Israeli narrative. Either they know that they are doing it on purpose because they think it serves Germany or whatever, or they are really totally blinded and ignorant because of the way the German intellectual elite developed vis-a-vis the question of Palestine. But we should say large sections of the young German society, in the civil society, we should remember it, demonstrate in the thousands every week for Palestine. Young students and young faculty members really courageously face a German academic establishment that threatens to throw them out and suspend them, and nonetheless they continue to do this. We have to remember that Germany has one of the largest Palestinian community in the West. So I would not lose hope for the German society, but the present as political establishment, cultural intellectual establishment, is really it's a shameful chapter in Germany's history that is meant to compensate for another shameful chapter, but is doing exactly the opposite.
We just have literally a minute left, Ilan, but finally, what gives you hope these days in these very dark and relentless times?
Well, I must, you know, I have a Center for Palestine Studies in the University of Exeter, which has about 40 Palestinian postgraduates or people working on Palestine. And through them, I can see the networking to other young Palestinians and pro-Palestinians around the world, especially the young people. They give me a lot of hope. They have a clear vision for the future. They have a huge amount of energy and levels of commitment. And I think that they have the power to lead us into a different future. And with the kind of processes I described before in our conversation, I really think that in the medium run, not the long run even, we will see the beginning of a different kind of reality. Our greatest fear is for the next year, 2 years, and 3 years. But if we can somehow survive it and do what we can to tame it, I think we are into a much better chapter in the history of modern Palestine.
Dr. Ilan Pappe, you are a legendary historian, writer, activist, scholar, and friend, and contributor to the Electronic Intifada. We are very, very grateful for all the work that you have done over the decades and continue to do. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Ali.
Hope to have you again soon.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Inshallah, of course. I would love to do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Incredible. Thank you, Ali, for coordinating that interview. That just,
I mean, Ilan is someone who, as I said, I consider a friend and I've known for many, many years. And he was so far ahead of many people on a lot of issues in terms of understanding and explaining what Israel is and what it would become. And he's, as he said to us, he's giving us brutal honesty when he says he doesn't think things are going to improve in the short term. But the fact that somebody who is so rooted in the reality and the utter horror of what we're seeing still has hope for the future is something that is important, something to hold close.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you. You are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Ali Abunima. We're going to turn now to our next guest, Dr. Ben Thompson. Ben has been volunteering in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip since 2013. He recently returned from Gaza. He worked as a medic during the Great March of Return in 2018 when Israel deployed snipers to murder and maim thousands of unarmed civilians protesting the siege of Gaza and demanding their right to return home. He's also taught annually at the Islamic University of Gaza, now destroyed by Israeli bombing, but he helped develop multiple medical education programs there. And he was suspended from his job in Toronto last October after calling out a Canadian Israel lobby group for dehumanizing and inaccurate comments about Palestinians. Dr. Ben Thompson, thank you so much for spending time with us on the Electronic Intifada live stream.
Thank you so much for having me. And I'm really humbled to be on immediately after the brilliant historian, Dr. Pappe. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Where do we even begin? Talk about your most recent trip to Gaza. As I said, you've been going to Palestine over the last 10 years. What was different this time and what were you doing there now?
Yeah, so Nora, I've been, like you mentioned, I've been going since 2013, but I was actually there in September 2023. So I had a really good sense of what was happening immediately before October. And of course, having read the news, as all of us have, having lost friends, loved ones in Gaza over the last several months, and myself being a humanitarian, I've extensively studied the situation on the ground and heard daily from my friends and humanitarian aid workers who were there. So I expected to see a humanitarian emergency. I expected to see a humanitarian disaster. I had read about genocide. I had not seen it with my eyes before. Certainly, I've been to Gaza during bombings before, but this was something completely different. It was beyond my worst expectations. And despite the horror that I saw, I'm actually quite hopeful that at some point Gaza will develop a healthcare system by Palestinians for Palestinians, because every day I was there, I met another amazing physician or an amazing patient who, despite everything that they've suffered, is just showing outstanding resilience.
And you're a specialist, you're a nephrologist. And
kidney doctor.
Yeah, kidney doctor, right?
That's right.
I mean, what is it like? I mean, just the logistics of specialty care at this time, you know, how are you able to diagnose, let alone treat chronic illnesses or diseases at a time when specialists are being murdered, equipment is being destroyed, and basic diagnostic tools and equipment are simply unavailable?
You know, I think of one girl that I saw in Gaza. As a kidney doctor, I don't usually see children. Most of my practice in Canada is only with adults. But given the very limited access to subspecialty care that predated October in Gaza, that's been a problem that's been a long time. You know, just as an example, prior to October 2023, there were two board-certified kidney doctors to manage over 2 million people in Gaza. Just to give you a comparison, in a city like Toronto or a Canadian or North American center with a similar population, you would expect to have about 20 to 30 subspecialists for that population. So they already had a fraction of what was needed. And Dr. Hamam Alo, a very young but incredibly talented nephrologist, was killed in his house with his father and father-in-law. The head of internal medicine, who also himself did some subspecialty nephrology or kidney medicine care, Dr. Rafat Labad, he was killed. And one of the other doctors who was doing kidney care, Dr. Abdullah, who was in fact running the Shifa Hospital. The Shifa Hospital, of course, has been bombed, and we've all seen what's happened to the Shifa Hospital over the last few days. They simply can't provide care, either because they themselves have been killed or the resources to provide care don't exist. And if I go to that 18-month-old girl that I saw, it's quite a revealing case. You know, Reem came in with her mom in one of the primary care clinics that I was working in just about a week ago in Rafah. And I was able to establish that her spleen and her liver were both much larger than I would have expected. I could feel lymph nodes. There really wasn't blood work available, but the very, very limited blood work that we had access to suggested that she probably had cancer. And we were worried that she probably had lymphoma. Now, typically we diagnose that by doing a biopsy and to sending it to a specialist doctor who would look at it under a microscope and establish the diagnosis. We would typically do that after doing a CAT scan or an MRI or some type of imaging to identify, you know, whether this cancer had spread, for example. Unfortunately, prior to October, there were three MRI machines in Gaza. All of those have been bombed or destroyed and are no longer functional. Of the five CT scanners that were present in September 2023, four have been destroyed, and one of them is awaiting a part to be delivered once Israel provides permission for that to be delivered. So we can't do imaging. It also happens that the lab that would read a biopsy has also been bombed. So they basically can't read biopsies. And the two pathologists that would read that biopsy, even if we have a lab, both of them have been killed. So there is essentially no mechanism to diagnose cancer in a way that we could start treatment for this 18-month-old girl. Even if we could diagnose it in September, where did children with cancer get treatment? At Rantisi Hospital in Gaza City. Well, that's been bombed. So there's literally no capacity to provide this 18-month-old girl care. And so we had no choice but to demand through initially the WHO that approved it. And then subsequently, the second step is to get approval from Israel to leave Gaza, and to leave Gaza for perhaps going to Jordan or Qatar or some other location that might be able to provide this young girl care. Unfortunately, only one in two of the requests for leaving Gaza are approved for females, and it's about one in three for males. So you can see there's a huge amount of morbidity and death related to the destruction of the healthcare system. And, you know, traditionally when we think about, you know, the over 30,000 people who have been killed in Gaza, we traditionally think about it as far as bombs, explosions. That's the typical way we think about it. But we forget about the fact that people like Reem, young children like Reem, who have these new diagnoses that are completely survivable if they were in a healthcare system from September 2023 that hadn't been completely targeted and decimated, we forget that she's also a casualty of this genocide.
And this is on top of 17 years of a blockade that has now been effectively normalized. Like, you know, I just hearing that there was, you know, one MRI machine for 2.3 million people, that has been normalized. And I mean, what capacity did specialists like yourself have in Gaza during this, you know, this 17 years of blockade until October? And how do you see it? I mean, just, yeah, like it's just kind of unfathomable to think that those were the good old days now in terms of
It's a really good question. So in 2013, I did my first visit in Gaza. And at that time, I was doing a needs assessment for internal medicine and kidney medicine. So I visited most of the health facilities throughout Gaza at that time. And at the end, I had to create a report that was provided to the health authorities, essentially so they could target investment to determine how best to improve those programs. Now, the very first recommendation that was suggested by the team of doctors that did this assessment was that if the occupation and siege didn't exist, there would have been no need to do the assessment in the first place. And I think that's so true of so many of the interventions that take place in Gaza. So many of the NGOs are there doing work that would be completely unnecessary if the Palestinians were given the freedom without a legal occupation to create their own health systems. You know, you've mentioned the topic of subspecialist physicians, and it's a really important topic. You know, one of the things that I identified on that first visit is that, you know, you have over 2 million people and one cardiologist, one heart doctor. You have, at that time, one kidney doctor. And that's impossible. Like, that's simply impossible to provide adequate care. And why does that exist? Well, it exists because those very determined, heroic physicians in Gaza, they want to learn. They want to develop their own programs to teach other physicians. But part of that requires them to leave Gaza and to go to international centers of training. And overwhelmingly, they have almost no opportunities to do that. And oftentimes their applications to do so are rejected by Israel. So instead, they rely heavily on international groups coming in and doing that training. But you can imagine how difficult that is, because often those applications are also rejected. So, you know, I initiated a charity in 2013 that was focused specifically on enhancing medical education in the occupied territories of Palestine, which include, of course, West Bank and Gaza. And we've had significant challenges. The overwhelming majority of the people we've trained have been in West Bank simply because it's almost impossible to get in and out of Gaza. And that problem won't change unless the occupation is abolished.
Yeah. Ben, you were in, as you've told us, you were just in Gaza. Describe to us a day in Gaza. Just what you wake up to, what you see, what's it like around you? What's it like trying to work and to heal people in this situation? And talk about where you were exactly in Gaza, if you can.
Absolutely. So I was part of a group that was evaluating non-communicable diseases. So this means things like diabetes, blood pressure, cancer care, dialysis care. And as part of that evaluation, I was located predominantly in the southern part of Gaza in Rafah and Khan Yunis. We did do a site visit as well to Al-Aqsa Hospital, which is at that point was the hospital the farthest north that we were permitted to go, admittedly with quite heightened security protocols to do so. The average day of most people in Gaza is 24-hour around-the-clock drones. So every moment of the day, you hear the drones above. Every night, your sleep is interrupted by explosions. I didn't get one night where I wasn't woken up by bombing. And that's a way of life now for everyone, for the majority of people in Gaza who are now in the south. In addition to that, I think it should be stated that the majority of people in Gaza have access to such limited water that it's under 20% of what would be considered the international standard of 15 liters. Most people now have less than 3 liters a day. And the people who are living in the tent cities in Rafah, they have one toilet for every 800 to 1,000 people, limited access to water. They're lucky to get one meal a day, and oftentimes get no meals a day. When
we actually have some pictures you shared with us. I don't know if you can see that, but feel free to talk about some of these pictures and what they show.
Yeah, so the picture you're seeing there is in the Mawazi tent city camp. And what you see there is essentially a block. It looks like a block of cement, but it's actually a toilet. There's a hole in the middle, and that serves about 800 to 1,000 people. There's one of those blocks for about every 800 people. You can also see that there's no door, so there's absolutely no privacy, and there's no lights. So what we found when we visited this tent city was that while people were using this at night, you can imagine that's not accessible to people with physical disabilities. It's not safe for people to use at night because they simply can't see. There's no privacy or dignity with using it. So what had materialized is that a lot of the people living in that area were able to walk down to the beach, despite the fact that raw sewage is now being left to drain directly into the ocean. People are using the ocean to bathe. That has dramatically increased the risk of diarrheal illness and skin infections. There isn't access to water except for water trucks, which is limited to about 2 to 3 liters a day, which people have to use for everything. Food preparation, bathing, cleaning their clothes, everything. It's simply not enough. So people are barely living. They're barely surviving. Limited food, limited water, no hygiene. It's an absolute disgrace to humanity that this is allowed to happen, because the entire world has known about this for months and months and months. What you see here in this picture is a number of tents that have been built immediately adjacent to the Israeli border. And children who live in this area will often walk up to the fence and try talking to the Egyptian guards. And this is...
So that's next to the Egyptian border.
Correct. This one is immediately adjacent to the Rafah border. In response to this, and under the concern that some people from Gaza would escape, so to speak, to Egypt, Egypt, since October, has reinstituted a second set of fences immediately after this set of fences that you can see in this photograph here. Again, further disconnecting Gaza from the rest of the world. And so what you see here in this photograph, this is a photograph in the Rafah area where there are massive numbers of tents. We talked about the lack of sanitation and hygiene, the very high rates of infectious diseases. What you see here is a graveyard. And so previously there were three graveyards in Rafah, but the massive death toll of over 30,000 people, there simply wasn't anywhere left to bury them. Initially, this was confronted by trying to dig up some of the graves in which family members could also be buried in with people who were already buried in the Rafah cemeteries, but that became impossible to continue. Subsequently, this cemetery was built immediately adjacent to some of the tent cities. And what you'll see here is only approximately about one third of the entire size of the cemetery. Sadly, they don't have enough space to bury one person per grave, so they're often burying three or four family members in the same grave. It's absolutely horrendous. One of the doctors that I know quite well from my previous trips, he used to run a hospital that has actually been bombed in Gaza City. He subsequently moved to Rafah, where he now resides. Three of his four children were killed in an airstrike before he moved south, and they're buried in this graveyard. His wife is also buried in this graveyard in another part of the graveyard, separate from her from his three children. And so people are living amongst this unlivable conditions immediately adjacent to those very people, their loved ones who have been killed. This picture is especially difficult for me because what you see here are they've run out of grave stones. And so what they're using instead is cinder blocks. And the cinder blocks you see there, the smaller ones, I was told, were for children. And you can see here there's a massive number of small cinder blocks representing one and often more children who are buried together from the same family. And you can see in the background, this graveyard is immediately adjacent to a very densely populated tent city. This is how people in Gaza are living. They are literally living amongst the dead. And they themselves in conditions which are not compatible with life. As a humanitarian, I've studied the humanitarian principles, right? These are things that are part of our religion, so to speak. We know about humanity, neutrality, impartiality, independence. These are our guiding principles. And, as a humanitarian, I'm appalled that what we see here is inhumane. And I find it impossible to be neutral in a situation where literally what we're seeing is genocide. We see here as well in this photograph, this picture was also taken in Rafah, and what you see is a food tent, and you see hundreds of people lining up for the food tent. This is just beside the tent city that I showed you also in Rafah. There's really two reasons why people line up for anything in Gaza right now. One is for food, and one is at banks, where government workers hope that the bank opens and provide them whatever small fraction of salary they're entitled to so that they can support their families. Here is a lineup for food, and if the people in this lineup are lucky, they'll all get one meal on that particular day. Many of them will go home with no food. In the city area outside of this photograph, we commonly saw children walking with empty pots, banging the pots, hoping to find food, hoping to find someone who would bring them food, and often, not eating at all. Children in this area were almost all barefoot. We saw in one of the wound clinics hundreds of wounds related to mass displacement, people moving from the north to the south. One case particular is very, memorable to me was it was actually a doctor, a very heroic doctor, who she she and her family had been living in northern Gaza. She's a student at the same university I teach at, Islamic University of Gaza. And her family had been displaced not once, not twice, not even three times, but four times, each time moving from one tent to another tent. And by the time she had her fourth displacement event, she ended up living in a UN.
That was a panel discussion from Electronic Intifada on the horrendous genocidal onslaught against the people of Gaza by the State of Israel, backed by the United States, Britain, the European Union. That will conclude our program for today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal, the special worldwide radio broadcast for Friday, March 22nd, 2024. And if you'd like to have access to this program, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire, so you can follow these stories related to events in Palestine and West Asia, on the African continent, Latin America, and indeed throughout the world, just go to the Pan-African Newswire at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. We'll close out with the music of Judy Mowat from the album entitled Black Woman. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
Must be somewhere out there to be.